very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here in London, with me, Tyler Brulé. Ahead in the next hour, we'll be looking at the headlines hitting Asia as their day starts. Also, there are major developments in Bahrain as an independent report condemns the violent crackdown earlier in the year. We'll hear from Al Hayat journalist Baria Almudin from Manama. Also, we continue our examination of soft power with broadcaster and cultural commentator Peter York.
If you're creating valuable brands, you have to have a brand-creating culture. And that's a real difficult thing, because they haven't got a brand-creating culture. They've got a brand-copying culture at the moment.
That was Peter York talking a little bit about China. We have all that and much more right here on Midori House on Monocle 24. But first, the news with Fiona MacDonald.
Running battles flared again in central Cairo today, despite riot police reinforcements guarding the Interior Ministry. Riot police had earlier pulled back in what seemed to be an effort to calm tension. The death toll has risen to 37, with a further 2,000 wounded in 6 days of protests targeting the ruling army council. But clashes erupted after nightfall as military police showered tear gas on the stone-throwing demonstrators and fired guns in the air. Earlier today, Sky's Tim Marshall described the scene from Tahrir Square.
Well, the battle is raging up and down the street that leads to the Interior Ministry. It's been tense all day. It's been non-stop, to be honest with you. Non-stop barrage of tear gas, stones and Molotov cocktails being thrown the other way, a steady stream of ambulances.
The UN Secretary-General has announced that the Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh will come to New York for medical treatment immediately after signing a deal that would ease him out of power. Ban Ki-moon had said the Yemeni leader is now in Saudi Arabia to sign the deal brokered by the Gulf states. The International Criminal Court's chief prosecutor, Luis Moreno Ocampo, now believes that Muammar Gaddafi's former intelligence chief, Abdullah al-Sanusi, has not been captured. Officials from Libya's National Transitional Council said on Sunday that Sanusi had been captured the day after Gaddafi's son, Saif al-Islam, was caught, and in the same southern desert region. Moreno Ocampo did, however, say that the trial of Colonel Gaddafi's son, Saif, can go ahead in Tripoli. He said that he had many questions to answer.
We have evidence proving that Muammar Gaddafi, Saif al-Gaddafi and al-Sanusi were managing an operation to kill civilians, persecute people, abducting them, torturing them, and then many would disappear.
Pakistan has appointed a former information minister and human rights campaigner as its new ambassador to the United States, moving quickly to fill a post left vacant after tension between the civilian government and the military. Sheri Rahman had replaced Hussein Haqqani, who resigned yesterday, days after a Pakistani-American businessman accused him of being behind a memo that said the military was plotting a coup. Russia's current envoy to NATO, Dmitry Rogozin, had said that the US-Russian attempts to reset their diplomatic relationship were insufficient, following an announcement from President Dmitry Medvedev that Russia may load long-range missiles with warheads capable of foiling a US anti-missile shield in Europe. Medvedev, addressing the nation on state television today, expressed regret that talks on cooperation with the US and NATO on a European missile defence have not produced an agreement. Nokia Siemens Networks, the world's second largest maker of mobile phone equipment, is to axe 17,000 jobs, nearly a quarter of its workforce, to help save about a billion euros a year. NSN, which has struggled to make a profit since being set up in 2007, did not say where it would make the cuts. It's faced aggressive pricing from rivals and an economic downturn that's forced many telecoms companies to cut spending. European Commission President José Manuel Barroso unveiled detailed proposals for much more intrusion into Eurozone countries' budgets, and he set out options for the introduction of common Eurozone bonds. The Commission has presented a draft regulation which would allow it to review draft budgets of Eurozone countries by mid-October and ask for revisions if they were not in line with EU budget rules. However, he also issued a stern warning.
I'm measuring my words. Without stronger governance in the euro area, it will be difficult, if not impossible, to sustain a common currency.
An independent report into Bahrain's crackdown on protests earlier this year has found that the authorities used excessive force. The panel was formed by Bahrain's government to investigate any crimes committed during the worst unrest seen in the kingdom for years. More than 40 people died and a number were found to have been tortured. King Hamad of Bahrain expressed his dismay at the panel's findings. Those are the latest stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks for that, Fiona. Nice to see you back.
Thank you. Arrived this morning.
Very good. Anything we need to know from Scotland, from the Highlands?
Oof. Well, yes, a little pollution in the sea lochs from fish farms.
Right.
Is that exciting?
That is. What does pollution look like?
Good question. I think it's very small. They're for fish farms that they've been prolific on the west coast, and they're fed all these nasty toxins that get rid of the sea lice. But of course, it affects all the other wildlife in there too.
Absolutely. We'll see you in about 24 minutes with the headline check. Thanks.
Indeed.
We are going to go over to Thomas Schaffernecker now, right at this moment, with the weather.
The weather, in association with Kiwoni Travel.
And nice weather currently developing across Portugal, Spain and France, and that trend will continue into the weekend. Sunshine here, meanwhile across Italy and the Adriatic, clouds and showers. Here's Thursday's city forecast. In Copenhagen, 9 Celsius, partly cloudy. Frankfurt, 4 Celsius and cloudy. In London, it's 13 with some sunshine. And in Madrid, 14 and sunny. And on air travel, a very strong jet stream close to the UK and bumpy flights, strong headwind for transatlantic flights to North America. And across North America, heavy rain has been sweeping the eastern half of the US, adding to travel problems in the lead up to Thanksgiving. Very, very soggy weather across New England, for example. The good news is that Thanksgiving itself will be sunny. And the rest of the United States, sunshine. Thursday's city forecast, New York City, 16 Celsius and sunny. Chicago, 14 and sunny. In Miami, also sunny with 27 degrees. And in Los Angeles, around 15 degrees and partly cloudy. The Far East now, rainy weather across Japan at the moment, but conditions should be improving. In Hokkaido, however, blizzards are expected towards the end of the week. Here's Thursday's outlook. In Osaka, 15 Celsius, partly cloudy. In Tokyo, it's 18 Celsius, also partly cloudy. And finally, a look at Australia. A rainy end to the week across southeastern parts of Australia. Thunderstorms too. Thursday in Sydney, it's 20 degrees with a chance of showers. That's all from me. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernecker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Thomas. You're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. We're back in a moment with some headlines from Asia as the papers are just coming up, but first, a short break.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Ein Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei ole kosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Broca Jalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And welcome back to Studio One here at Midori House in London. Just a quick scan of what the Asian papers are reporting as they come off the presses. The Straits Times of Singapore is talking very interesting story for anyone who wants to move into the retail business, particularly in India. Headline that India close to opening up $586 billion retail sector. This is Dateline AFP. It says India's cabinet could decide as early as next week to throw open the nation's vast retail market to supermarket behemoths, such as the likes of Walmart and Tesco, in a bold but highly controversial reform. As foreign multinationals have lobbied for years to be able to sell directly to India's 1.2 billion consumers. The Japan Times is talking about a positive step between China and Japan. Dialogue procedure eyed for the Senkaku rows. Japan and China are considering creating a new procedure for dialogue to forestall and solve problems concerning the Japanese control of Senkaku Islands, diplomatic sources says. This must look like something like a new red phone between Beijing and Tokyo. Wall Street Journal Asia is saying that China to cancel college majors that don't pay. Seems like a very Chinese move. So that means for any graduates who might be entering the market with a rather useless degree, Chinese education authorities are going to be looking at how to rectify that situation. The Australian, also with staying with a China headline, China to top world in e-commerce. By 2015, it says that China, already home to the world's largest online population, population is likely to replace the US as the world's biggest e-commerce market by 2015, according to new research. And if anyone was listening to our programs over the last 24 hours, of course, one of the big problems there is, of course, are people going to be getting the goods they thought they were buying? We had a report from the one of the Shanghai papers talking that about the fact that people can actually buy, of course, fake invoices from the major luxury goods companies to go with the fake bags that they buy. The South China Morning Post says China manufacturing hits a 32-month low, so not great if you've got a factory out in Shenzhen. And the Taipei Times 2012 elections, Tsai registers for presidential elections as the Democratic Progressive Party, the DPP chairperson Tsai Ing-wen, yesterday registered her candidacy for the January 14th presidential elections. And also, not great news also for the manufacturing sector in Taiwan. The Taipei Times also reporting that factory output growth hits a low. It says that export orders across all sectors slow to single-digit growth. Figures for the commercial sector were the highest this year after July. And that's a scan for what we've got out of all of the papers. Actually, maybe just one or two more things. The Age in Melbourne is saying that the Inner West gives Leafy East a run in the livability stakes. So it's probably something for us to consider for our quality of life survey come July, August. The results of a new research exclusive to The Age and also the Melbourne magazine should give heart to those who live in the Inner West of the city. Livable Melbourne, a study by Tract Consultants and Deloitte Access Economics, shows several Western suburbs have become as livable or more livable than their Eastern counterparts. So anyone who's looking to pick up a bit of real estate, you might be wanting to head to those parts of Melbourne. Those are the scan of the headlines right now. We are coming up to just 12 minutes past the hour. That's 12 minutes past 6 o'clock here in London. We're back in a moment.
This is Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 podcast, yeah.
Monocle 24 e yokuso.
This is Monocle 24.
Tama on Monocle 24 Nigeria.
Dobro pozdravljavat. Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
And you are back with Midori House, live from Studio One here in London. Well, of all the countries involved in the Arab Spring, the small Gulf state of Bahrain may have suffered the worst damage to its image. The oil-rich nation had been turning heads in recent years for its progressive stance towards women, the political process, and its efforts to attract foreign investment. I think many of us remember all of those high-profile ads that were running in newspapers, magazines, and on television just before the uprising. So no one could have predicted the government's violent reaction to protests in February and March. An Egyptian American professor named Sharif Bassouni was tasked by the king this past summer to write an independent report. Bassouni was charged with investigating the protests, crackdown, and aftermath in the hopes of restoring the public's trust. Well, the report, which came out earlier today, is just being analyzed by many journalists. And we wanted to catch up with Baria Almudin, the foreign editor of Al Hayat, who is on the line right now from Manama. Hello, Baria.
Hello, good evening.
Good evening to you. I'm wondering already if, I guess, you're monitoring the press there. What kind of coverage is this? Is this obviously lead story in the region, or is the broadcasters there, are they leading with what's happening in Tahrir Square right now?
No, actually, there are two lead stories today from the region, from the Gulf region. From the Arab world, of course, the story of Egypt, as you mentioned, but also the story of Yemen. There is a lot happening in Yemen. As you know, the president of Yemen signed in Saudi Arabia this evening. So that's a major story, and hopefully one will see the end of the troubles of Yemen. Another major story, of course, is the presentation of Bassouni's report to the king of Bahrain. It was held in a ceremony which I attended, and where the Bassouni gave a very interesting speech and gave the report. He gave a brief of the report, which is more than 500 pages. And he gave only the highlights. Of course, the king also answered, King Hamad bin Isa Al Khalifa answered Bassouni, and the speech also proved to be a very interesting speech as well. I think it's the first time that an Arab leader calls for the establishment of a human rights court in the Arab world. I think that's extremely interesting.
As you were attending the speech, how candid or frank was Bassouni's delivery?
Oh, I think it was very candid and very, very powerful indeed. He basically accused the government of behaving brutally with the protesters and abusing human rights. He did not, however, say it was systematic. He said there were 30 people that have died from the population, from the protesters and others bystanders and some expatriates, but 5 people also from the police. And he was very candid telling the government that they have to change laws, that they have to change the training of the police, because he did say there were mistakes committed by the police in Bahrain in treating the protesters, basically saying there were human rights abuses. But to be honest with you, from an Arab point of view, what the king said was pretty interesting as well, because not only he promised that he's going to make amendments to the laws and to the way that the police are being trained, but as I said, the establishment of this academy, or this not academy, sorry, of this court, which will be a very welcome news in the area. Also, he promised that he is going, his government will actually take all what Bassiouni has recommended for the government to do, that they will do them all. Indeed, he said that things have started already. It's quite unfortunate, however, that there are some protesters and some of the population here, but mainly the Shias, who have apparently not accepted this. This is not widespread, but some of them are demonstrating and protesting as we speak.
And on that note, I want to come, Barry, in a moment to the damage or the restoration, maybe, after this report of what this means for Bahrain Incorporated. But I want to go back to, the divide between both the Shia and Sunni communities. What does that look like? And I'm wondering, again, from how this is either being, discussed on the street or certainly in the papers and on television, how candid is the discussion this evening about this report?
Oh, no, it's indeed very, very candid. You know, I mean, there is some kind of a free of a press in Bahrain. Also, the, Twitter, Facebook, everything is quite available and there. However, one important element in the Shia-Sunni divide, which is not only in Bahrain, but it's all through the area. It's in Iraq, it's in Lebanon, and it's very, very unfortunate. And of course, it's fueled by Iran. Iran is known with its involvement in the affairs of Bahrain, unfortunately. I mean, throughout the history, Iran has made claims to Bahrain, for example, every now and then you hear somebody either in the government or the clergy or whatever saying that Bahrain is the 53rd, governance or whatever. And then, of course, many times there were coups reported in the Kingdom of Bahrain, and there have been some involvement of Iran in them. Just recently, 2 weeks ago, Qatar had arrested 4 or 5 Bahrainis, and now the matter is being investigated, and it seems that Iran is as well involved. And of course, we have seen lately, indeed, the king actually talks about it in his speech, saying that the media in Iran and the media that is paid by Iran in the area, indeed in Lebanon as well, has fueled tensions in Bahrain. This is documented. This is and the king says, sort of extends another hand to Iran, saying that they should stop meddling in the affairs of Bahrain. The regional aspect as well, of course, you cannot talk about it without talking about the position of Bahrain. Bahrain is situated in a place where the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, where all the oil is just across the bridge. As you know, there has been a bridge that has been erected between Bahrain and Saudi Arabia almost 10 years ago now. There's a lot of trade that goes on between the two kingdoms. And it's very strategic, the position of Bahrain for Saudi Arabia.
Just before we go, Barry, is there a sense on the part of the people, and I think also observers as well, that it's wonderful that a report has come out, and indeed a very frank one, running to 500 pages, as you say, but also that the horse is already bolted as well, and will government reform and action and certainly the issue with I think what happened with the doctors and medical staff in the hospital,
yes, sure.
Will there be the appropriate steps taken now?
Yes, sure. I think the Bahrain actually talks about what happened with the doctors in a very detailed way and says that some of them indeed have exercised, they did something wrong in those hospitals. But they, of course, the medics have already been retried in the civil courts. So many of them have been released already, and many of them, still are awaiting trial, because as far as Bassiouni's report is concerned, he did states in details. It's very difficult to tell you now the detail is, because it's 500 pages. I haven't covered it yet, but it does talk about the and mentions who were the guilty ones and who were not the guilty ones, and in what way they were guilty. Going back to your question about the population, I think there is a divide, but I think the majority of the Bahrainis welcomed what the king say, and they see this as a new beginning. Of course, provided the test is this going to be, is what the king is saying going to be actually, to follow through on his promises? This is the main thing now, I think. I asked Bassiouni after he finished, because he had known the king, he had met him many times, and I indeed spoke to the king himself, and he did assure me that there will be a follow-up, and this is very serious, and we take this very seriously, and he called for the unity of the Bahrainis. Bassiouni said that he thinks from his meetings with the king, from with the government, etc., that they are taking the matter very seriously. And they have, he told me that they have indeed reinstated many of the employees that have been, kicked out of their jobs during the troubles, etc. But Bassiouni said he thinks that they will. Myself, I wait and see what will happen. It looks promising. The kingdom needs to move. It's a tiny kingdom, and the economy is in trouble already. So if there is no real reform following this, I think we will see more protests indeed. It looks promising, however. I really think it does look promising. And let's not again forget the involvement of the regional powers. For Saudi Arabia, this is a matter of strategic for its security and the security of the oil of the world. God forbid if anything happens, can you imagine what will happen to the economy of the world? The oil, says that you're talking about Saudi Arabia, that has the second biggest output in the world. So this is not as the press unfortunately portrays it. There's a much more depth to the situation of Bahrain and to what's happening in Bahrain.
Indeed, it's not a story which is just limited to the streets of Manama where you're reporting from. Barry Al-Madin, foreign editor of Al Hayat, thank you very much. You're listening to Midori House. We're live from London. We're back right after this.
This Christmas, why not give the gift of Monocle? A Monocle subscription spreads happiness and cheer throughout the year. Our special gift subscription is for only the most deserving recipients. The first issue comes hand-wrapped in Monocle design paper with an accompanying welcome letter which announces your gift and a personal message should you so wish. Subscribe now and we'll also send the new exclusive tote bag for 2011 with the first few issues. Our 12-month gift subscription costs £80 sterling, including magazine delivery costs to anywhere in the world. The recipient of your gift will receive 10 issues of the magazine and also 12 months access to all of our online content at monocle.com. So whether they've been naughty or nice, why not give them the gift of Monocle?
And you are back at Midori House with me, Tyler Brûlé. And I'm also joined by one of our correspondents from Moscow, Rachel Margie. Welcome.
Nice to see you, Tyler.
Nice to see you. So we wanted to talk, of course, we've been focusing a lot on issues of soft power. We're going to have a report from Peter York in a moment, a rather lively interview, where he does, and I think you probably heard on the menu at the top of the program, where he talks about China. But we sent you off to the rather sort of mean and sparse borders of Russia and China. And I want to... And you know, a story that you've delivered over 16 pages. I mean, first, just tell us about what is happening, because oftentimes you fly from Tokyo to London, and you go, you're flying over this wasteland, and you see sort of the odd pocket of lights. But we shot it in wintertime. It's bleak, but is it a land of sort of opportunity though?
It's very beautiful. But I mean, just the scale, the distances are really hard to convey until you see it. You drive, it's almost kind of mesmerizing. You drive through these endless birch forests and it's kind of meditative, the kind of play of black and white that moves in front of you. Mm. But it's an incredibly rich region. I mean, there's a lot of raw materials under the ground. And
yeah.
That's what China needs to power its economy. So there are a lot of opportunities for both the Chinese and the Russians if they can look at it in the right way.
So tell us about the relationship between, because you went to, twin cities, that are divided, by a river. So the personalities of what happens on the Russian side and what happens when you get to China.
I think it really feels when we went there, it was actually before they built this pontoon bridge, which is going to open up this winter. But so at the time that we were actually trundling across the ice in little trucks. And it really did feel like driving from 2011 back to 1991. I mean,
and this
China
is between the city of Heihe
and Blagoveshchensk.
Yeah,
and Blagoveshchensk is one of the oldest cities in the Russian Far East. So it's got buildings that date from the 1800s, and long history of good universities. But there's a real feeling like the Russians keep saying, "Oh, it's a Potemkin village over there. They've just built all this stuff on the riverbank. They just want to look good, but there's nothing really behind it." And it's like, they've built all this stuff on the riverbank. They've got 400,000 people.
Right.
They'll have 2 million in another 5 years,
yeah.
And you guys better get with the program if you want to take advantage of this. But I think, it's hard for the Russians to see it as an opportunity.
It's when you look at the story, and of course, we've captured people in both cities on both sides of the river. When you look at traffic flows, more Chinese going into Russia or more traffic the other way?
Oh, far more traffic the other way, because the Chinese make it very easy for the Russians to come over.
Mm-hmm.
It's a visa-free zone. You can pop
both ways.
I think just... Yeah. I'd have to get an update, but
right.
It was like, no, it's not a visa-free zone for the Russians.
Right.
For the Chinese coming to Russia.
Yes.
But there's a sort of free trade area where Chinese can pop over for the day. Russians can pop over for the day. They can do their shopping. There's fabulous restaurants serving whatever kind of Chinese food you want. And there are spas. And so basically people go off and they do their day trip and they book into a hotel and they have their foot massage and they go for their spa treatments and they go for a couple of nice meals. And then they do all their shopping and they bring it all back.
Right.
And when you get back to the Russian side, there's really nothing going on.
Right. So if you looked at the demographics or certainly looking at the socioeconomic strata of the Russian side, is there deployable wealth? Because, I'm just wondering, and again, the Russian side does look, damn bleak. So is it people going over to buy, a lot of tat and bring it back? I don't think there's probably Louis Vuitton stores there yet. For the Russians, or
probably only a matter of time, though.
Right.
I mean, I think if people felt that there was an opportunity there, I think that the demographics are huge. Like that in the sort of three provinces adjoining Russia, in Russia's northeast, China's northeast, there are 138 million people. I think there's something like 7 million people in an area the size of Belgium on the Russian side, and falling.
Yes.
They have the kind of death rates in Russia that are equivalent to having a war. So if they want to harness the power that they've got with raw materials, they really need to look at a way of attracting Chinese investment, attracting Chinese companies, making it easier for people to invest and cutting through those layers of bureaucracy, which is something that China has been very good at in, opening these little pockets where foreign investors can come in. And the Russians are just really scared. They're really scared that the Chinese are going to overrun them.
I mean, that's we've reported from Khabarovsk, we've reported from Vladivostok before, and you still get, that real sense that, people are not looking to, maybe they're looking to Japan if they're in Vladivostok to get some cheap cars, but they're not looking to Tokyo. They're still looking back to Moscow. And I'm wondering if this is the same sense, when you're there as well, or do they say, no, at least at a local level, we need a relationship with Beijing?
Oh, at the local level, and particularly at the young level, there's a real kind of, there's an age gap, but young Russians in the Far East can see that there are enormous opportunities. People are starting to study Chinese. They feel that they've got a future on the other side of the border. They feel very let down by leaders in Moscow. They feel that people in Moscow just aren't really interested in local development.
Mm.
They've got their own priorities that are very, very remote from people, they're 7 hours remote. Sure, exactly. Flying times remote from people.
So do you think there's also a generational fascination with all things Asian on the part of these young Russians as well? Not that it's just land of opportunity. And I'm not saying they're all playing necessarily, Mandopop and Cantopop, on their, iPods. But, do you think there's also a bit of a cultural fascination with Asia as opposed to, again, like looking back to what's happening in St. Petersburg or Moscow?
I think it's just a feeling of where the opportunities are. I think that cultural thing is going to come. One of the things we touched on in the story is the Confucius Institute. Mm. And it's really interesting. I mean, they've got a lot of money. They've got a lot more money than the Goethe Institute has now.
Yeah.
And, they're putting people all over the world rolling out Chinese culture. So I think the economics will come first.
Right.
And then the culture will follow.
Mm. And I just want to look back at them. There's some extraordinary pictures also architecturally. I also some real architectural shockers too on either side, of the river. But just, the pace of development and renewal. What are you seeing? I mean, is there money at a Russian, government regional level for them to pick up and step up, the infrastructure versus, of course, just the breathless pace of what's happening in China?
I mean, the Russian side they can't hold a candle
No.
to the breakneck pace of Chinese development. And bureaucracy moves much more slowly in Russia. And I think that's kind of a function of the weakness of the government rather than the strength. If the Chinese decide they're going to do something, they just enact it.
Yes.
But if the Russians decide they're going to do something, there are all sorts of different competing parts of the power machine and wheels and cogs that have to turn. So it's just much harder, I think.
Rich Marju, I don't know, where are we sending you next?
I don't know. We'll have to talk about it.
I know. We'll have to have a discussion and we'll have to have you come back and sit in one of the co-hosting chairs.
That would be fun.
And you can read more in our December, January issue. It's the nice glossy section in the back, 16 pages by Rich Marju. Thanks very much. Fiona McDonald is here with a scan of the headlines at the bottom of the hour.
Thank you. Running battles have flared again in central Cairo today, despite riot police reinforcements guarding the Interior Ministry, which has been a flashpoint for violence. The Yemeni President Ali Abdullah Saleh has signed a Gulf initiative to hand over power to his deputy as part of a proposal to end months of protests that have pushed the Arab country to the brink of civil war. A disastrous German bond sale has sparked fears that Europe's debt crisis could be threatening Berlin, with the leaders of the Eurozone's two biggest economies still firmly at odds over a longer-term structural solution. Prime Minister Vladimir Putin has warned Parliament that Russia's elite should unite under his strong rule to ensure stability in an uncertain world, dogged by economic and political turmoil. Turkish President Abdullah Gül has warned of a Sunni-Shiite divide that he said could pitch the Muslim world back into the darkness of the Middle Ages. Some of Libya's clans have said they would not recognise the government a day after the unveiling of a new cabinet revived regional and tribal rivalries which threaten the country's stability. China says it will conduct naval exercises in the Western Pacific this month, an announcement that came a week after Washington reinforced its Asia-Pacific footprint with plans to operate US Marines out of northern Australia. And a United Nations Environment Programme report shows that by 2020, greenhouse gas emissions could rise more than forecast to between 6 and 11 billion tonnes above what's needed to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius. Those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thank you for that, Fiona McDonald. I'm not going to see you now. I mean, I'll see you, I guess tomorrow. But you've got other friends for Late Shift tonight. I think I've done two shows. That's it for today.
You're going home to put your feet up. I bet you're not.
I'm not. We have a small concert happening next door. Hopefully, we won't make too much noise. It's just coming up to 3:34 in Tokyo. It's 1:34 in Bangkok. 20:34 in Tallinn, and it's 12:34 in Chicago. Now, all this week, Soft Power Week is in full swing here on Monocle 24. And a soft power is the economic and cultural clout of a nation delivered through entrepreneurial engagement and branding bravado rather than dated politics or military muscle flexing, just in case you missed it over the past 2 days. We've been finding out which countries have it, which countries have lost it, and which nations might do well to take soft power and certainly flex their muscles in a more effective way. One man who never has a shortage of well-aimed pointers is renowned author, broadcaster, consultant, and cultural commentator Peter York. He and I played a little word association game earlier to see which countries, in Peter's view, get the most reward for their soft power assets. I wanted to work through our list and just sort of get your view on how some of the nations, and I preface this by saying that I think that, you know, any country that's made our top 30 is doing a decent job. Somehow Greece managed to sneak in at number 30. Now, if you're looking at Greece's soft assets, which I think it has quite a few, you know, they're in a terrible predicament. But what could Greece do to rise up the league tables?
They can't play on antiquity. There's something brilliant that enabled them to play a role on a world stage at a certain point in time. So we want to hear about, actually, Greece in the world, because proportionately a lot of Greeks get out of there and do clever stuff. Greeks are enterprising. And in that sense, small countries like this one sends people over the world are enterprising. And it'd be very interesting to see how the Japanese reacted to the I'm sure the Japanese never think about Greece, but I'd like to know.
So you're thinking we don't have to go back to the classical period.
No.
They need to go back and maybe excavate a bit of the 60s and 70s.
Yes.
A bit of glamour.
The classical period, there's a huge distinction. The more they talk about the classical period, people will say, well, very different from now. No, there's the 60s and 70s thing, which you can really play with Greece sort of featured in the world. Golden Greeks.
Mm. We'll skip over to the Czech Republic. 28, Russia.
The negative factor is that lots of respectable Western businesses are scared to death of Russia as an investment place. They'd rather invest around it because they think that their senior managers are going to be either embarrassed or kidnapped, or one way or another, they're going to be required to do a level of bribery which they're not experienced in, or the road to their factory won't be laid. So people are scared of Russia, and the billionaires club makes it worse. So there's an immense resentment against the Russian rich. So what about the Russian people, the rest of them? Let's hear more about the Russian people. Let's hear about progress, if there is any, do you know, in the middle of Russian society.
We'll skip over Israel, Portugal, Chile, Turkey. How do we feel about Turkey?
Turkey, one good thing going for them is they're taking a role in the world. You know, they're talking about Syria, all that stuff, all that development. And there are lots of Turks here, so we can sort of connect with that. And the idea of an emerging nation betwixt and between. On the other hand, the increasing apparent Islamization of what was a sort of very secular place worries people. And there have been some dodgy enterprises from Turkey. I mean, they've been doing quite a lot for the last 20 years in terms of national branding.
Well, they've built half of the Ukraine. I mean, so many parts of what's working in the ex-CIS have all been sort of done by Turkish engineers. So maybe that bit is good.
I think I like Turkey acting well on a world stage, a world regional stage. And I'd emphasize that, you know, the current players talking sensibly and being part of the world moving forward rather than backwards. Mm. I like that stuff. Time to play a role that distances Turkey from that general sump of Middle Eastern, North African impressions, because that's where they're in a very curious position between the East and the West.
Mm. Let's go way east. Number 20, China.
I think that, again, I want to see more Ai Weiwei's doing stuff, and not, you know, disproportionately important to people like me is when you learn that intellectuals, artists get persecuted and it's very highly followed and very much publicized, you want to learn that the opposite is happening and that the process whereby you move from the great leap forward with huge sacrifice is moving on to creating higher value things, which is competitive, but nonetheless, I mean, and along with that, you have a higher value society where people are getting all sorts of new freedoms, because inevitably you get those freedoms and the culture changes and becomes a bit more world citizen-y.
Does China jump up the ranks by also creating, not just making, but by creating brands that people want to purchase? Because, you know, we often have this conversation saying, yes, you've got lots of things, you know, scattered about your home that are made in China, but how many Chinese brands?
They're aiming. They know that. That's certainly one of the lessons that, you know, the five-year plan includes creating valuable brands. And I think the corollary is, if you're creating valuable brands, you have to have a brand-creating culture. And that's a real difficult thing, because they haven't got a brand-creating culture. They've got a brand-copying culture at the moment. That's a very, very great challenge, having a brand-creating culture.
Let's go jump a two up from China, Austria, you know, number 18. Place where they still make things.
Yes.
And some decent institutions, but maybe a little bit dusty.
I think Austria is fascinating. And if you've got a relatively oversized city like Vienna at a crucial point with so much history, relatively little development in Vienna. So you've got that Ringstrasse, heavy late 19th century feel. You've got Sachertort. You've got all those historisch museum-y things. It's quite difficult to get through the feeling that this is a survival. It's a sort of Len Dayton case. I like it like that. It can't be good for them. And actually, there are very few Austrian stories. Swarovski is brilliant, because Swarovski has created a brand out of something that wasn't so branded and got involved with culture in a very clever way. Actually, Austrians are quite good at making things, so why can't we have other brands doing things like that?
Mm. Italy, number 16. So despite itself, Italy still manages to have, quite an important role on this list, because they make things. They have international brands. My goodness, there are some problems in Rome. But, could Italy vault into a top 10, do you think?
Well, it's everybody's favorite culture, in a sense. Across the world, it's certainly everybody's favorite food at almost every level. Huge masses of really important brands. What's given pause to people's feelings about Italy? A nation that allowed Berlusconi to rule it. It gives you real acreage of thinking there's something very, very wrong there. And it'll take a long time to clear it up, but everybody wants it to be cleared up. They're all rooting for Italy because of the cultural product. So the soft power is there. It's the hard stuff that needs fixing.
Mm. We've got Finland at 15, South Korea at 14, Spain at 13. Let's get to the top 10. Denmark, 12. Norway, 11. Netherlands, 10. The Dutch. Let's stop in Holland for a moment.
Okay. Well, for this nation, the Dutch are terribly sympathetic at every level. There are great parallels and some not parallels. And the Dutch see themselves as rather like us, and we see them ourselves as rather like them, and we've got a conjoined history. And you're starting to think, what are the Dutch doing at this very moment? You think, what's happening in Holland? No news from Holland. Is that good news or bad news? What are their debt ratings? But the Dutch seem secure.
Mm. And is it because of Royal Dutch Shell, Unilever? Philips hasn't been great of late.
There's a fantastic group of really important international companies which are Anglo-Dutch.
Mm.
And are successful.
Canada, 9. Switzerland, 8. Japan, number 7. Japan rose this year, partly also sort of a bit of an outpouring of international goodwill, where you realize that actually, despite all its problems, the world rather likes Japan.
I think it does now, and is sort of rooting for it. Intellectuals of a certain kind in the 80s used to talk about how Japan was going to take over the world, and there were books written about comparison of American and Japanese industry and so on. And then gone.
Mm.
And while that was happening, while people thought that Japan was on this fantastic ascendant, they would say, oh, Japanese culture is so lovely, and Comme des Garçons is the most wonderful designer in the whole world. So, as Fran Lebowitz once said, money is the best beauty treatment.
So, at number 6, we have Sweden, Australia, 5, Germany.
Germany, well, suddenly, Germany is the pivot, the crux, the arbiter of our world, of Western Europe. Germany's culture, for all intents and purposes, is expressed through its fantastic consumer goods. And we get no news from Germany except about its economy and its fantastic metal bashing. I want to know everything else.
France, number three, plenty to say there. But I want to go to the top two very quickly. So UK, down from last year. Is there a bigger opportunity for it to go to number one or for it to end up at number 12 if it's not careful?
Well, we exercise all sorts of soft power very effectively. When we talk about punching above our weight in diplomacy or militarily, I think that's self-delusion. When we talk about punching above our weight in all sorts of soft things, I think there's a case for it. I think at the moment we're holding, because on the one hand, and these things are tied to economics and people's perceptions of economics. So long as we are seen as being the people who do the brutal cuts and have a good borrowing rate, whatever else happens, we will be seen as having succeeded, unfortunately.
And finally, USA made it to number one this year. Does it deserve to be there?
I think, do you know, Tom Wolfe said the last century was the American century. This century patently isn't the American century because America has to share it with other people. It's the relative decline. There are more people on the stage. It still acts in a slightly empty imperial way.
When we look at brands, American TV formats, shopping at the Gap, do we like all of that still?
Not that much. There are American brands which I very much like, and I'm infinite American inventiveness. But no, the point at which I locked in to American commercial and popular culture was fantastic and dominant and exuberant and amazing. It's none of those things for me now.
And that was the ever-opinionated and brilliant Peter York. In a moment, we're heading over to Ottawa. We're going to be talking to Evan Solomon of the CBC about Canadian soft power and do they know how to use it or not. And we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Midori House from London.
You can now listen to Monocle 24 as it was engineered to be heard on a radio. Monocle's design team has been working with the talented people at Revo Technologies in Scotland to develop a special edition of their Heritage G2 radio. It's capable of streaming in thousands of web-based radio stations. The Revo Heritage also pulls in FM, DAB and can dock iPods and iPhones. With its elegant aluminium and walnut finish, the Special Edition Heritage's best feature is an M24 button that will take you direct to our live stream. You can buy your Monocle 24 Revo Heritage at shop.monocle.com or through our stores in London, New York, Hong Kong, Tokyo and Osaka. The Monocle Revo Heritage G2 for easy, elegant listening.
And welcome back to Midori House. We're in Studio One here in London. I'm Tyler Brule. We're going to continue our chat on soft power and go over to North America, where there's an ongoing battle. In an attempt to minimize America's sphere of influence on its neighbor to the north, the Canadian government has mandated that all broadcasters air a certain percentage of homegrown content. And of course, there's a body that ensures broadcasters are following the rules. And those rules are rather strict. For example, 35% of what's aired on commercial radio must be Canadian in origin. Now, it seems rather perverse because on one side, they're limiting the inflow of what's coming in when maybe they should be working a little bit harder on what's being broadcast around the world. Anyway, to maybe engage in that discussion, we thought we'd speak to someone from the state broadcaster CBC. Evan Solomon is on the line from Ottawa. Hello, Evan.
Tyler, my old friend, I can only tell you that just calling us the state broadcaster, we will immediately be at loggerheads because we are the public broadcaster, not the state broadcaster.
I know, and I think we're in such a habit because we're talking about, you know, so many state broadcasters from, you know, the Maghreb and elsewhere. But, you know, the behavior, though, Evan, you know, it is very much like a state broadcaster. Of course, maybe it's not only mandated, you know, by the CBC, but of course, there's a governing body above it. I want, you know, your opinion. I mean, does this make sense? You know, is it good for Canadian talent that 35% of what goes out on the airwaves is Canadian, when maybe what should be happening is, you know, they should be buying you more satellite dishes for the CBC, CBC News, to have more of a global reach like it once did?
It's been a question that's been going on for 30, 40 years. There is a system for, let's just talk about music, and then we can talk about television. But music is an interesting example. We've got a system here called Maple System. It's a content system that really measures what qualifies as Canadian content by music, artist, performance, lyrics. So it's, of course, it's a Canadian acronym, and it judges that. What's happened since the sort of MAPLE system was established, and it's been rejigged a number of times, is that the Canadian music scene, without a doubt, has blossomed. We have international acts all over in all sorts of different genres. Whether it's Feist or Celine Dion or the Canadian tenors or Broken Social Scene. And CanCon has, that's what they call it, Canadian content. These regulations have absolutely created something of a hothouse culture. And it's because we live between two giant influences. Everybody listens to American music. We can get their radio stations. We can get their television. It's a very robust, very non-regulated system. We also are very much influenced by the British system. And we get all that European and British music. So for a country of 33 million people, and it's not dissimilar to other countries that have regulations that are smaller. I mean, France has one, Ireland, Israel, South Africa. There's lots of countries that have these kind of regulations. We do think, and I think it's actually helped create the music scene. I think it's done something for television as well, because it's just cheaper to purchase American television or to listen to other music. So I think it's actually been really helpful. Your question, though, is, are there other ways to do it besides just put up walls? And the answer is yes. Music is a non-rival system. We have to import more and listen to more to generate new ideas. And then you're right. That productivity is lowered by protectionism. So we've got to get better, work harder at not only creating our own music, but exporting it. And one of the kind of surprising trends of globalization has been not that everything looks the same, but the rise of the value of localism. Good local ideas resonate throughout the world. And Canada's got to have the cultural confidence to understand that and to not be afraid of that. By the same token, open borders when you're right next to the United States has been pretty injurious over the last number of years. And so a certain amount of this protectionism has allowed us to grow and then exert cultural soft power around the world.
Do you think there's also a missing story here as well? And maybe the CBC can do an investigation on it, because I think, you know, with all of this CanCon element, it's somewhere, you know, in a back room, is it skewed in favor of women? Because, you know, you mentioned, primarily mentioned women. You think of Nelly Furtado and Shania Twain and Katie Lang. I mean, it all works in favor of women. I mean, and, you know, who's risen to the world stage as a male? I mean, recently, maybe Michael Bublé. So what is it also with just, you know, Canadian female talent? What are the men doing?
Great question. Maybe there is a conspiracy that I'll get into. It's the rise of the female. But I would say that there are some incredible men. Brian Adams is a big star. The Canadian tenors are big stars. There's lots of men that are stars. As you say, Michael Bublé.
Not as many as the girls.
I should say Nickelback.
I want to go though, outbound, and let's move on from music. But certainly, when we did our soft power survey, and you know, we looked at where America's ended up, let's say the role of a public broadcaster, stroke state broadcaster, like the BBC, for example. And one thing when we were debating the results is we said, you know, here's Canada. You know, this is an English language nation of scale, which has a different story to tell, which is not an Australian one, and it's not a British one, and it's not an American one. Do you think that there is room, and could Canada, and whether it's the CBC or is it a coalition of private and public broadcasters, be doing a little bit more to be getting the third message out, which is one which, you know, comes from Toronto, Montreal, Ottawa, and everywhere in between?
I'm trying to figure out what the goal of exerting soft power is. A part of how I would interpret it is telling your stories on an international stage where the borders don't matter, and having an influence, your ideas shaped in song, in film, in design, whatever they are, your cultural ideas resonating around the world. I think the institutions that are required on one level, some of them are the public broadcaster, but the public broadcaster's fundamental goal is to make sure that talent has a place to be nurtured, whether it's in news, whether it's in film, whether it's in television, whether it's in radio. The privates also have to do it, but I think everybody realizes this is the power of art, and you know this very well. Any artist, whether they're a filmmaker, songwriter, designer, architect, their goal is to communicate and to make sure that those ideas resonate. Now, the question is, what policies do a country have to help artists do that? I would say Canada is weak in terms of the policies of spreading what you're calling soft power, for one reason. We don't see it as a tool of foreign policy the way we used to. Our foreign policy has really failed to use culture as a form of diplomacy, ambassadorship, soft power. I would say if there's a great weakness in Canada's foreign policy, and I think it is a foreign policy question, it's recognizing the power of culture. The U.S., the Brits, the French, they do it. Canada lacks confidence, lacks funds geared towards that, and they lack a goal, which is what is the Canadian place in the globe? And I think that's the problem of a middle power. They don't really understand how to punch above their weight because they don't have a sense that their stories might resonate beyond the borders. And that has to do with a young culture that lacks confidence. And I think you see that in, you know, cultures like Australia, cultures like Canada. These happen. And whereas you measure it against Britain, or the U.S., more mature, more robust, on a much larger scale, they have not only the confidence to produce the stories, but they sense that those stories matter around the world, exerting a series of values. Because after all, what is culture? I mean, this is the question. It's just a set of instructions that communicates values in a different way. You know, there's values in how we design things, what we sing. They tell who we are, what we care about, and what matters.
And you know, and that's certainly something which can't rest at the doorstep of external affairs in Ottawa or Canada's equivalent of a foreign ministry. You know, it also starts, you know, very much at home. And I think, you know, it strikes me that part of the challenge is, you know, where is the architectural homegrown architectural greatness in Canada at the moment? And, you know, when you look at industrial design, I mean, you can draw sort of quite a long list. You know, is there a Canadian vernacular in architecture if you look versus Australia or even New Zealand right now? And I think it's also, you know, perhaps, you know, largely where those priorities sit, you know, really at home. And, you know, and if you don't have them at home, how are you going to export them?
I think there's places. You would know a city like Montreal, which has an island mentality because it is an island. Then it's also a cultural island. That creates its own inner confidence, its own deepness, its own richness. If you look at the films that come out of Montreal, the music that comes out of Montreal, the architecture, the clothing design, the furniture, Montreal has a depth, and throughout Quebec, but let's talk about the major urban center like Montreal. It's got a confidence and a depth and a cosmopolitan nature, despite the fact that it went through, you know, some economic decades that were tough. It has blossomed as a Renaissance culture. There's a certain voice to Vancouver that's emerging, a confidence that kind of speaks to the Asian Pacific. Toronto's got a more of an anxious culture of, there's a striving and a grasping side to it, but nonetheless, there's an ambition that started to articulate itself as well. And, you know, you see those. I don't think Canada's got a united cultural center yet, but I do think you see pockets where that's starting to emerge. And the question is, does it emerge to become a national identity, or does it stay in almost these city-state cultural values?
Yeah, and I think also the bigger issue, you know, even looking on the business side, is, you know, is it important that the world recognizes that, you know, that Bombardier, you know, is a Canadian brand, that, you know, that their journey from A to B has been facilitated, you know, by a company which is maybe making, you know, train sets in Thunder Bay, which is headquartered in Montreal. But we're going to have to leave it there. I hope to see you very, very soon, Mr. Solomon.
I'd like you to come back and help rebrand the entire country.
Okay, well, it's not going to involve maple leaves, I'll tell you that much.
No maple syrup and maple leaves?
Absolutely not. We'll chat very soon. And that's all for this edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Constance Cheng, and our studio manager was Mr. Funnel. Nick Kelly is here with the headlines. Actually, no, Fiona's here with the headlines. That's all for now. Goodbye from Midori House.